This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I travel to sit face-to-face with my guests in their own homes to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. I'm often asked how Anchored came to be. The short answer is that it stemmed from a television series that I used to have. Limited airtime meant that my interviews were cut into sound bites, leaving some truly wonderful history sitting on the editing floor. I thought it might be time to dig into the archives and share some interviews that took place at a time when I'd never even dreamt about starting a podcast. This week's episode features Chris Henshaw, a dear family friend and renowned reelmaker from the UK. I met up with him 6 years ago on the banks of the Kispiax River to learn more about his experiences as a young man helping Hardy through some tough times. Let's just start off totally relaxed. We edit the crap out of these things.
Oh, right. That's good. Because I'm very nervous.
Well, we'll probably only get four minutes of it.
Okay.
And we are just going to tell your story a little bit. And I'm going to lead you through it.
Okay.
So the only thing I'm going to need you to do that's a little awkward at first is I need you to tell me in a moment your whole name and what you do in the fishing world. So go ahead.
Right, my name is Chris Henshaw, and I'm from England, the north of England, a little place called Barnard Castle.
Okay.
We have a nice little river there, the River Tees, which was devoid of salmon for 50 years.
Oh, really?
And I was one of the people, the first people that was instigated the returning of getting the salmon back into the river. And I'm glad to say now we are getting a steady return every year, and it's for the last 3 or 4 years it's improved. It's not fantastic, but it is improving.
It's on its way.
So they cleaned up the pollution in the mouth, and the only problem is that we've got quite a few seals down at the mouth, and they're doing a lot of damage.
We can have that problem too.
Yeah, well, they put a barrage in down there, and the fish pass has been in for 10 years now, and it still hasn't passed the environmental standards. We keep pressuring them and hope to get there in the end.
Why don't you tell me when you started coming to British Columbia and why?
Oh, well, I fished in the UK. I fished since I was about 5 years old. And then I was in the army, and I did a lot of fishing down in the south of England when I was there on the chalk streams. Then I moved up. I moved up north in the army. I met my wife. And came out of the army, and there was a nice little river where I lived, and I became... I was actually the secretary of the Angling Association there for 12 years.
Oh, really?
So I did a lot of... we bought 9 miles of water, so our club now has 9 miles of its own water, and it's only £35 a year for the members, so it's good.
That sounds like a great deal.
Yeah, yeah. So then I got into the collecting of old reels and things, and I did it for quite a lot of years, and I met quite a lot of people, and I met a guy called Roger Still.
Okay.
Roger was here last week.
Oh, is he from England as
he's
well?
He's from England, and he's been fishing in British Columbia here with Jim Adams for the last 20-odd years.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
Right, and so me and Roger became very, very good friends, and he's dealt in old tackle since he was 14 years old, and he's 50-odd now, like, so... I started to... I did a little bit of engineering when I was at Tech at school.
Right.
And... I didn't only start collecting tackle, I started repairing it for myself. Oh. And then other people at the auctions started bringing stuff for me to repair. And then I got so repairs were coming in from all over the world. And even Hardy's was asking me to do repairs.
Oh.
And that's how I became involved with Hardy's, because I started to get to help them to design some of the prototype work for the factory.
Mm-hmm.
And then... well, there was a little bit of controversy with repair work, because it was getting, you know, what's a repair and what's a forgery? You know, the closeness of the, you know, how do you draw the line? So there was a lot of hassle in the UK a few years ago. So probably about 10 or 12 years ago, I decided to manufacture my own reels. And I started doing a little blog on one of the classic forums, and people started saying, oh, well, I want a reel. And it snowballed, and I now have about a 2-year waiting list for my reels.
That is excellent.
Yeah, and I'd retired from my work by then, so I just do it as an hobby spare time, and I use the money to help the grandchildren out.
Right, well, so, that's a good cause.
Yeah, that's a good cause.
So when did you first come to British Columbia then?
Oh, sorry, I came here about, I would think the first time I came about 12 or 15 years ago.
Wow.
I think it would be 12 years ago, something like that.
And was it Roger who suggested that you come here?
Roger came, and we came to Mr. Clay's here. And Bob was by this time buying a few reels off Roger and collecting. And I'd made a reel, and this is the reel. Wherever it is.
Is it this one?
This is very much like the reel. This one's slightly different. Did you see?
Let me see that. That is so beautiful.
And Bob took an interest in it. And I was actually fishing on the Bulkley. And there was a guy came up the stream of the jet boat. And he drowned me nearly. Because he come over and he said, gee, what's that reel? And then he set off in the jet boat and drowned me again.
There's a drag on this.
Yeah, that's got a disc drag in it, and also a click button, a click inside. But it's a classical style with the Hess handle.
Yeah, it looks extremely traditional.
Now, what I did was with this was the reel that I... then I became involved with Hardy's, and they were on about... relaunching the Cascopedia.
Oh, yes, a beautiful reel.
So I designed the prototype along with their Ed Reel Maker, and I made the original prototype for the Cascopedia, the ebonite one that was made.
And when was this?
I can't remember the year now. It must have been 70... I can't remember the date, April, honestly.
That's okay.
It must have been 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But what happened was, anyway, I made the prototype reel, and they hadn't got any production reels, and they hadn't got any ebonite, which I had in stock.
What is that?
Ebonite, it's like a hard vulcanized rubber.
Oh, and what's so special about it?
Well, it's light, and all the old classic reels was made from it, the Vom Hoffs.
Really? That's interesting.
The Walker reels, the Vom Hoff reels, the Zwarg reels were all made of ebonite. And the ebonite is... that's ebonite, the handle as well, the Hardy reels, the early Hardy reels.
Oh,
Okay. Went from ivory to, or ivorine to ebonite.
Got it.
So, I made this first prototype reel for Hardy's, and it was stamped 01. No, sorry, it was stamped, the prototype reels for Hardy's, we always use 000. Hardy's always kept 1, 2, and 3 of the reels, but I kept the 000. So this reel, they hadn't got any, so they actually used it for the adverts in Japan. And they also had used it for the magazine of the for that particular reel.
Wow.
So that was a bit of a success because Hardy's were in desperate trouble at that time. And I'm very proud of the fact that my reel helps keep the factory going at that particular time.
Why would there be trouble in a reel company like Hardy, who's been around for years?
It's sad, really, but it's the Far East. I mean, I can give you I've got a perfect example in the car there. I've got a rod in the car with a reel, and the whole outfit's $120.
Not a Hardy, though.
No.
So Hardy may have been seeing trouble because there
were... Hardy's were in trouble because of their... They did move some production to the Far East, but maybe they did too little too late, they maybe weren't quick enough in the move.
What's so special about Hardy?
Well, Hardy reel has always been, even from the right from the very beginning when old man Hardy invented the first perfect. It was perfect by name and perfect by nature. I don't think there's ever been a better reel designed anywhere. There's been good reels, the Charltons and the Vomhoffs. Probably Vomhoffs were as good in its day. But for the English tradition, everybody wanted to own Hardy. And the craftsmanship was second to none. There's an old story with Jimmy Smith that used to be one of the early reel makers there. And old LRH Hardy used to walk around the workshop because they were all on time and motion then.
Oh.
They all only got paid for how many reels they made. And if he saw a scratch or a mark on it, he carried a hammer. And bang, if the reel wasn't good enough. Only the very best left that factory, and everything was inspected in detail and inspected again.
Tell me about your perfect. So obviously we both love the perfect.
So what happened was I started doing this blog on the forum there, and people started saying they like my reels and could I make them one? And then I started to think, well, as I moved on, I thought, well, why haven't Hardy's done this? And I'll try and improve it a bit. So, for example, the main thing that I think I improved was a lot of people want... Hardy's hardly ever made left-hand wind perfect reels.
Yeah, that's right. I know.
It was very, very... In the 40s or 50s, and a lot of people, especially in Scandinavia, started using perfects, but they couldn't get all the left-hand wind ones. And Hardy's had only ever made very, very few. So they were very, very expensive. So I started to get requests for left-hand winds. And I made them in the traditional way until a guy from the Great Lakes bought one and he rang me up and he said, Chris, I've had a disaster with one of your reels. And I said, no, what's happened? Like, you know, has it dropped a bit? No, he said, but I was playing one of the biggest trout I've ever caught in my life. And the spool dropped off into the water.
Oh, no!
And he said it took me 25 minutes to pull the line up because as I was pulling it up with it being a lake, the line was coming off the spool. So that made me start to think. And so I thought, well, why have Hardy's stopped this? Because you have the little retaining screw on a left-hand wind.
Yes,
but that's the only thing that stops the spool from unwinding.
Right.
Because the spindle's a right-hand thread. So I thought, well... Maybe if I put a left-hand spindle thread on. And it's not easy to do. It's easy to put it on the spindle, but to put it onto the spool and then turn the spool, it's not easy. So I did this, and it's been a success.
May I see? Is this it?
No, that's a right-hand one, I think.
Oh, you've got a lefty here.
Yeah, you can get that one out first if you want.
For my 30th birthday, my brother-in-law bought me a Hardy Perfect, and I cherish it.
Yeah.
And he told me that finding a left-hand retrieve was... damn near impossible.
It is. Mm. But that's the one I built. That's the one that I built for Marty.
Chris, they're so gorgeous. I can't believe you've built this.
That's a bronze line guide, which Hardys didn't have. Oh, and this little bump on the front here, which Hardys don't have. If you notice with a Hardy, it's flat there.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was a better idea to make the spindle a little longer so it was a little more secure.
This is so gorgeous.
And these little indentations here are what they call cusps.
And what does a cusp do?
They're for putting your leader all. You know, if your leader got stuck, you could, and you want to take the spool off, you can put the line through it.
This is such a gorgeous reel. Tell me, how long does a reel like this take to make?
It takes me about maybe a good 2 weeks.
Wow.
That's if it would probably take me a month if I was. You know, didn't have to, you know, it depends on what time, how I feel and what I've got. It depends what I have to do with the grandchildren, you know.
Right. Did you have a history in machining before reels? No,
well, when I left school, I went to, I worked in a mining area, and you either went around the mine or went to the steelworks or in the army. So I went down the mine and I went to technical college and I did a little bit of turning there, like, and then the mine closed, so I joined the army. And I never did anything then up until I more or less met Roger. And I went to this guy's house with the old tackle, and I went to buy some tackle off him. And I came back with his grandfather's lathe. So that was the start.
Yeah, right.
And I don't tell you about the first reel I ever made. Roger, you were in hysterics.
Do you still have it?
No, I don't still have it. I'm going to tell you a story about my reels. I don't have very many at all. So I ended up making this, buying this lathe, and I went from there. I bought myself a little mill, and I knocked the part of the garage out, built a little beast on the side, and filled my time in there.
This
and
is
now
great.
I've made reels for. I actually made a reel not so long back for. There was a reel that Hardy's made called the Alter Reel, which was a 6-inch diameter salmon reel.
For the Alta?
For the Alta.
Ah.
And it was specially made for the Duke of Roxburgh. And everybody wanted one of these, tried to get one of these old reels. Well, there was only very, very, very few made. So I decided to make one for myself.
Yeah.
And I finished it. And this Russian guy got in touch with me and he asked me if I could find an Alta reel. I said, well, I do know where there is one, but well, I know where there's a couple, like the Duke has one. So I said, yeah, I know who's got one, but I don't think he'll sell it.
Right.
Not yet. Anyway, I was talking to this guy later in time, and he decided to sell it. But in the meantime, I'd mentioned to this Russian gentleman, he actually lives in Finland, and he got mine out of me.
He made me an
offer I couldn't refuse.
So he's got
on his shelf now. He's got Mr. Henshaw's altar and Mr. Hardy's altar.
He's got both of them.
Yeah, and I also I took a shine to his daughter. She's about the same, a little bit older than my granddaughter, like, and I once made a little 1-inch. Nickel silver, all nickel silver, perfect reel.
Right.
So I gave it to her for a key ring.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So she's got it on a key ring.
Now, on the Alta, mm-hmm. I mean, this is very, one of the great things about this project is I get to visit friends of mine. And
yeah.
You and I met I guess it would have been last year.
No, the year before. Was it?
I think it was last June. Yeah, two seasons ago.
Yeah,
we met 2 seasons ago in Norway.
That's correct.
And we were both Atlantic salmon fishing on the Gala.
That's correct.
And I'll be honest, I was a little surprised to hear that you were a steelhead fisherman. You're English. You're a very successful and well-known Atlantic salmon angler, and yet you have the steelhead bug. So tell me why, what is it about steelheading that draws you in?
These are explosive. They're just ball busters. The Atlantic salmon has got nothing to touch them. They're strong Atlantic salmon and they're a bit dogged, you know, but these things can be dull, they can be explosive, and they're mind-blowing when they really explode. They're very special. They're a special, special fish. Roger taught me this. He said that they're a fish that has to be protected.
Yes.
They're just special. There's something about them that gets into your blood. And
you can't get it out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you want to catch them, and they want to kick your ass, you know.
Yeah. I do.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you see any comparisons between the Atlantic salmon world and the steelhead world?
I would say that the Atlantic salmon world is two stages, really. There was a lot of big changes came in probably 10 years ago, when the catch and release started in England. And it's got more and more catch and release now. And a lot of the people that had the famous beats don't fish them now, whether it's that they couldn't kill the fish or not. But I was once walking across quite a famous beat on the Dee not so many years ago, and I said to the friend I was with, I said, do you know 15 years ago, 20 years ago, me and you wouldn't have even been allowed on this grass.
Right.
Never mind fish the river. And to my mind, things have improved, so because everybody's getting a chance to salmon fish now if they want to.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah.
So traditionally, only the English, I mean, from what I understand,
only very wealthy people.
Fly fishing was a...
For wealthy, yeah.
It was a royal sport.
Yes.
And so the royalty would fish, and these rich people would go over to Scotland, where some of the best fishing in the world was, and they'd fish there. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And then there was some sort of economic change where the Scots were now also able to fish their water.
Yes, yeah. The Scots, there's quite a lot of association water now where they can fish themselves, but there's still a lot of water where they can't.
So how does that work?
Well, it works. The estates own the water. The Crown Commissioners and the estates, and they lease it out to hotels or some water. They always try and keep a little bit of water for the local people. Mm-hmm. It may be only a short pool or two, but still the majority of the water is... there's some private beats, some hotel beats, like, they're private as well, I suppose. And then there's the, like the Lurd Steelts. He still owns quite a lot of water.
Who's that?
The Lurd.
The
Lurd. Well, in Scotland, they call the owner of the land, like the guy
The Lurd!
He's the guy who owns the castle.
Yes, of
That's
course.
The best way of saying it.
The big guy on campus.
Yeah, he's the one who owns the castle, yeah.
Right.
And, so it's... I would say people have got more access.
Is it almost like New Brunswick in how it's run?
Yes, in a way. Yeah, yeah. For the private beach, yes, I'll put it on a par with that, yeah.
Is it surreal for you to come out here and see all this beautiful water and know that you're allowed to fish it?
Well, this is the great thing about coming to British Columbia, is that I can get a permit, and within reason, I can go and fish anywhere, just about.
Right.
And I like the rules as well. It's all catch and release, barbless, and I think that's what it has to be these days.
I agree.
And there was nobody worse than me for taking a fish if I wanted one when I was younger. You know, I've totally altered.
What changed? Why now do you not feel the need to take your fish home?
I don't like killing things. I used to shoot a lot when I was younger, and I stopped shooting at one stage, and if I wanted to kill a duck now, I would still do it. But I appreciate nature now a lot more than when I was younger.
That's a great answer. Do you know anything interesting about the tradition of Hardy in general?
Yeah, the Hardy family, they actually started off as silver cutlery makers.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And then the old man Hardy started... making the odd rods mainly, and they employed a guy called Walter Dingley,
okay,
and a guy called Slater from Newark, and they were some of the best reel makers in England at the time. Hardy's, they lived on the name a lot. The quality was second to none. but they made sure everybody knew it, and they made sure everybody paid for it.
They used
hammers. There was nothing to see. Well, there was nothing. They opened the big shop in Pall Mall in London, and there was nothing to see. Half a dozen Rolls Royces stood outside.
Got it.
They didn't go in and collect the tackle. They ordered the tackle, then sent the chauffeur to pick it up.
Okay.
And that's the way Hardys were.
Is there still that level of prestige associated with Hardys?
No, that's where they went wrong, I think.
You think?
Yeah. When that tradition went from England, they still thought that they were above everybody. And the ordinary person, by this time, there was a lot of tackle dealers and a lot of other companies.
Who'd moved in.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Do you think that British Columbians have a history? Or not, we have a history, but do you think that British Columbians are on the way to having the same tradition or a similar tradition to what the Atlantic salmon anglers do?
Oh, yeah. I've met a lot of steelheaders since I've been over here, and they're fanatics.
Mm-hmm.
They really are. I mean, they'll go to any lengths to, you know, any time of year, they'll tough it out to get a steelhead, you know, and... I think there's a lot of tradition in steelheading.
What do you think of this? I hear this often. There are people who say that the Atlantic salmon anglers drink fine scotch. They dress quite sharp. They stay in nice, you know, beautiful hotels. And the steelheaders drink whiskey, and they're grungy and dirty, and they like to
well, they're the only ones. They're
noodles.
The only ones I've ever seen here that get out of a truck. There was three this morning. I must tell you this story about this morning.
Yeah.
So I get up at 5:30, and I goes down there, and just dark. I hope Mr. Bear isn't there.
Right.
So I fish. Bob told me we fished below the island before the guide boats get there. So I fished below the island. The guide boat came, and I'm walking back up, and so. The guide boat goes, I come up behind the island and I decide to put a dry fly on to fish the run at the back. And I hear this boom, 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 this ghetto music. There's three guys, jumps out the truck, jumps in the river, and I've never seen three guys come across a river so quick in all my life. And one of them's a typical, like, First Nation guy, you know, And anyway, they got such a shock when they came around the island because I was stood there in the pool.
Oh, no.
And that, to me, typifies BC
steelheaders.
Rough, ready and get to it.
Yeah. Do you notice a difference in the older steelheaders compared to the younger steelheaders?
What, such as Bob, you mean?
Yeah. My generation versus Bob's. Generation?
Yeah, they wanted to learn. And I've actually been helping one out before you're talking to you down here. I met one in the patch today and he'd landed here with his truck and a little single-handed rod. He'd never seen a switch rod before. So I was showing him what it was and how easy it was, and we met a couple of the Indian guides and sort of put him in the right direction. And funnily enough, he's a local person that moved away from here and has come back.
As they usually do.
Yeah. And he started fishing, but he's totally got the wrong... He's only got the setup which he had when he left here. Things have moved on a lot since then.
They have. And that's really interesting that you mention that, because traditionally, the double-handed rod, it originated in Scotland and in the UK.
Oh, yes, yes.
And then, of course, it managed to find its way here, and it disappeared for a while, and now it's back.
Yeah, because of the, I think a lot of it to do with these switch rods and these spate lathes that's gone on in the States. I mean, you would never see an American here with a double-handed rod years ago.
Right.
And now you see them all with double-handed rods. Because it's easier, and it's the way to do it.
Right. This is the man where it originated.
It's double-handed castings has a fantastic history. It's fabulous, you know, when you go right into it. Alexander Grant, we were just talking about it the other night, his world record was only broken a few years ago, and I mean, something like about 80 yards he was casting with a 25-foot rod then, 25-foot green art rod.
Right.
You wouldn't have even been able to lift it, me, or, you know, no. It's so heavy.
The great thing about having the double-handed rod is, you know, you can cast without needing too much space behind you.
This is the great thing with the switch rod. That was, to me, for British Columbia, was the biggest improvement probably in the last 50 years.
Right.
Because it allows a guide to teach a total beginner how to fish within a very, very short period of time and enjoy it.
Right.
No hard work. And for the experienced guy, well, they're just a working tool that you enjoy.
And sky's the limit. You can.
Yeah,
there's
yeah,
always
yeah.
ways to.
Yeah, if there's a hole in the trees, you can get a fish out. I always remember Stig Nielsen, the gilly on the guide on the M, and he had a young lad called Rickard with him.
Right.
And he stood between these trees, and he said, he's trying his old cast out, and Rickard says, "But how are we going to get a fish out of here?" And Stig says, "First we have to hook it."
We'll worry about that later.
Don't worry about that later. Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. I've said that once or twice.
So, do you want me to show you the inside of one of my reels?
I actually really do. Yes, please.
Yeah, right, because the time's getting
gone. This is important.
So this. So I've made quite a few reels since I retired, and every time I make a reel and I use it for myself, it ends up with somebody else. The one on the rod here, I presented to Bob's wife.
Yes.
Because I started moving on, and she was wanting a reel like, so I presented her that with that one.
I have to thank you. Some years back when you donated that beautiful Henshaw reel to my fundraiser, Flash of Fins.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah.
Really, really appreciated that.
I've done a few of those. You know, what I'm going to be stuck with here is getting a coin in here. This one hasn't got a... I've got it.
So what are the materials that these reels are made out of?
Well, that's a brass foot. That's an artificial ivory handle. This one's got a real handle. That's made from a mammoth tusk from Alaska.
Wow!
Yeah. And then this is bar stock aircraft-grade aluminium.
Oh, okay.
So it's all the old Ardy reels were made from a cast aluminium, which cracked, and you only got to look at it and it broke. But this stuff's it's pretty strong.
Okay.
The line guard is bronze, so that should take on a nice patina when it ages.
What's the reason for the line guide?
Well, the line guide was originally made. I don't think you need them on modern rods. And I have quite a few customers that don't like them. They'd sooner... Whereas I put the extra pillars in here, four pillars, you can do it without a line guard, with three pillars, one here, one here, one here, and you will not catch the line.
But why traditionally did they have one?
Right. Because lines were made of silk.
Yes, of course.
And they wore the fine... The aluminium wasn't as strong as this. There wasn't the modern fly lines. There were rough silk lines, and of course they burnt a hole through the frame in the reel. So that's the only reason that the line guard's there. It's not to lay the line or anything like that. It's to protect the line.
Very interesting.
So this one, I decided, as I say, I ended up with not having a reel because people take my reels. So I thought, well, I stamp all my reels with my initials, and they'll probably be inside on that one.
Okay.
But this one, I've stamped it, CH000. And this one's, as I say, it's got a mammoth tusk handle. But the spindle is the opposite way, so it's left-hand wind.
Wow, and are those little ball bearings?
They're ball bearings, yeah. Spin all those in by hand.
How does this work?
Well, You see the little nailing I put on there, a little fancy nailing, and also on the inside of there, where you don't get any of this with a hardy reel. This is just me being posh. Yeah, so I made this one with a nickel-silver, all nickel-silver line guide.
Yeah.
This is all brass, and then I made the... All these pieces are all handmade. They're not made in a machine. These are made by my hand with a file. And now this piece, you see, is to make it, it probably takes you about an hour and a half. And the bearings, the separate race, and then I spin all the bearings in and spin them over. One I put inside it so that I wouldn't sell it.
Oh, my gosh. 000 Chris Henshaw, my own reel. Do not sell or give away.
Yeah.
Oh, Chris, that's so fantastic.
And this one I'll keep for the granddaughter, because she just started fishing. She's only 8 year old, and it's a nice little trout reel for her.
It's beautiful. So, Chris, what about reels without drags versus reels with drags? Why? I know for me, I love the feeling of it just being me and the fish without relying on a drag to help me land a fish. What's your take on why people prefer to have
Do you mean a disc drag or a drag reel?
A
click and pull reel. What you saw in there was a little pole, like a little tongue, going into a cog.
Mm-hmm.
And as that goes over like a clock, it goes tick, 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 tick. And then to make it the noise differ, you put a spring across the top of it, across the top of the tongue, and by applying pressure, that makes the click louder, but it also puts a little bit of tension onto the spool at the same time. Now, a lot of people are under the misconception, and I have to explain it to some of my customers. They say to me, "Oh, but the drag's not strong like on a modern disc drag reel." Well, I say, "Well, it's not supposed to be.
Yeah.
It's just to stop the overrun."
Right.
You have a palming piece here, which you use to break. Oh, I didn't know that. But it's amazing how many customers don't know that they're supposed to put the palm on here.
It's my favourite part.
And you know what the old LRH used to do with the perfect reel?
What?
He didn't used to wind it like play like a fish with the reel under there like that. He turned the rod over and he played the fish like that on the top.
Oh, really? Oh, that's classic.
Yeah, that's true, and I've got pictures of him doing it. So, in fact, if you happen to go and see Manfred, you'll see all sorts of pictures of the old things
I'll ask him. Now, that's very interesting what you just said. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, for me, I fish a click and pull because I enjoy, like I said,
it's the sound, isn't it?
I love the sound, but I love feeling connected to the fish and knowing that it's my hands that are the drag.
Yeah.
But I read in a book, I actually read in Topher's book, he said that one of the reasons why it's ideal to have...
Is this Jones' guide? Topheroy?
Yeah, Topher Brown.
Oh, no, yeah.
So in his book, he says that one of the advantages to having a click and pull is that you can gauge how fast the fish is pulling and at what speed the fish is running by listening to the rate at which the click is sounding.
Well, that's all right with salmon. But you can't do it with steelhead. They're too fast.
That's so true.
It just goes... Yes. I can remember down here, not last year, the year before, I was in the tail of Bob's pool here, and I'd never caught a fish on the dry fly, and this fish hit the fly so hard that it just about took the rod out of my hand.
Yes, yes.
I've never experienced anything.
I have seen it three times in my guiding career, the rod being ripped out of someone's hand.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
Yes. And today I told Tracy that I have not ever once caught a fish out of this river that didn't go straight to backing.
Hmm, that's true.
What's the difference between the Marquee, the Hardy Marquee, and the Hardy Perfect?
Well, the Marquee is just a standard frame click and pull reel. It's a simple reel. It's just got a click and pull on it and a palming. I suppose over the old traditional... Let's go back to the first reels. The first reels were plate wind reels, and they had a spool and a frame, and the spool was inside a caged frame and the winding plate here, but this was sealed. So Mr. Hardy had the great idea. He wanted a reel that he could palm.
Right.
So he invented the Perfect. Other people copied it. A lot of people, many companies, Farlow's, Garden, probably half a dozen Sharps, even later on in the 50s, they copied it. And it's been a really fantastic reel.
For a long time, I've been fishing the Marquee.
But be careful, the Marquees are okay, I would say, for salmon.
But they'll disengage a spring.
But I'll tell you, I was just going to say, I can guarantee you now that they'll blow the pole out, these steelhead, at some time or other. I don't know whether you've experienced that, but I can guarantee it.
Don't put that in there. But yes, it was my perfect. It disengaged.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, my perfect disengaged.
Yeah, well, I know a few customers that's had that done too, and I also know why that's one of the reasons why I would say 80% of my customers are either Americans that come here or Canadians.
That sounds right.
And with doing that spindle, they can't lose the spools like they've been doing with the
other reels,
not just Hardy, one or two with the, because if that little screw comes loose,
that's it,
you've lost the spool
and the fish.
Yeah, that guy in the Great Lakes lost it.
I'm gonna have to place an order. I'm slowly, you got dinner in 7 minutes, so I'm just gonna you, I've got that. Do you see any other similarities as a species between salmon and steelhead?
No, not really. The steelhead is like a, I believe it comes from the Schatzer strain of rainbow. The Canadian, they tried to import rainbows to England, you know. I don't know whether you knew that.
I did not know
but
that.
But yeah, well, in the 1950s, I think it was, or maybe earlier, they transferred some rainbows or steelhead to the UK. And there's only two rivers which the rainbow survives in now in the UK. And one of them was right almost at the side of where I was born. I was born in the High Peaks in Derbyshire. And there's a river called there, the River Dove, where Sir Isaac Walton, the grandmaster of when fishing was invented.
Right, and when was that? When was fishing invented?
I would think somewhere around about 1500 and something.
Was it Atlantic salmon or trout fishing?
No. They didn't. The very first rods never even had a reel on. They just had the line tied to the top of the pole.
Right.
And then it wasn't called a reel. It's called a winch.
A winch?
A winch. So winching something up. And their fishing was mainly for pike and things like that. I suppose in Scotland they maybe did, but I think a lot of them they took with the burning, what they used to call burning the water.
What's that? And
they used to light straw.
Oh, like the natives.
They used to go out in the canoes. With a spear.
That's right, I've seen
Well, they
that.
Used to use, the farmers used to use the forks that they turned the bales of hay with. They used to use those for the salmon.
Oh, dear, okay. When did the UK, or when did people start fishing for Atlantic salmon?
Oh, they started about 1885 or something like that, I would say. That's when the really took off. It used to take they fished in England. And then a guy called Jones designed tackle. But he also was the first person to organise what you would call a person that organises holidays now?
All of the...
Organises holidays.
A booking agent.
He was like a booking agent. He did the first bookings to Scandinavia. And he wrote a book called Jones' Guide to Norway.
Ah.
His name was Tolfroy. And his books today, if you can get one, fetch around about £7,000.
Oh, so that won't be happening.
Yeah, no. And they've got the reason they fetch so much money is not the fact that they tell you all about how to get to Norway, what to do when you get to Norway, how to find the rivers, how to book them. They've got the most fantastic plates of salmon flies, fully dressed salmon flies you'll ever see in your life.
Oh, I love those old books with those plates.
Yeah. Well, you can get the book from the Classic Library.
Oh, what's it called?
The Classic Library.
But what's the book called?
You want a Jones Guide book?
Jones Guide
I'll
book.
Get you one.
We will talk. I will definitely love to read that.
This
excellent.
Will just be a repo, like.
A reprint.
It's just a reprint. Yeah.
Yes, of course. Yeah. I've actually just finished reading The Lost, I think it's called The Land of Moses, or The Lost World of Moses. Mm-hmm. Have you read that?
No. But I'll tell you about this Jones Guide.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a little bit in there about the travel to Norway. And it took 6 weeks to get from the UK to get to the fishing then.
Right.
And when they went over on the boat, they were... In the book it says, I strongly advise that you get the upper deck because the Danes travel on the lower deck and it's rather...
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, and I got it. I had another book where there was two people that corresponded on the River Stordal in Norway, and it's there's a very famous fishery there. You went up and fished up on the Fora, on the Stordal.
I did. Oh, was that where I caught
that was
a
where
huge,
you were. Now I told you to. I think I said try and go to a certain place, but you wouldn't get there. You couldn't get there up at Marika.
Oh, okay.
Now Marika Lodge there was where the king, he was eventually the king of England, but he was just the duke then, and there was a fish in the hut there, which he caught, a wood carving. It's only about 7 or 8 pounds in weight, but it's still there in there today.
Oh,
in
that's
the barn.
So interesting.
Yeah. Well, even the chair where he sat in and wrote his diary is still there.
I'm going to have to get this stuff, because the book that I just finished reading, it's a book that was written by has been written by a historian, and it explains 1870 is kind of where it begins, with people starting to come over from the UK.
Yep, that's about that ties
Canada.
In with that ties in with the time when Hardy started in 1891, I think it was. 1891, and the Perfect was invented in 1896.
They weren't fishing for salmon in the 1700s?
They possibly could have been, but no, I don't know about it. I would think probably the majority of it was 1800.
Sounds right.
1850. And as I say, the early reels were all brass reels, very, very heavy, and all the rods were green art and
also heavy.
Very, very heavy. Yes. And the lines were made of horsehair.
Oh, really? Not
yeah.
even silk yet?
No. They were all plaited horsehair.
Jeez.
And it was all made in tapers, you know. So, and the tying the flies on, they used gut, of course. They discovered the silkworm gut, and that had to be soaked before they could use it and tie it. And so it was quite a big thing to go for a day's fishing when. You know, in those days on the beach in Scotland, they had rod boxes the length of those where those planks are. They're still there. Andy will probably show you some if you ask him when you're up there.
Ooh.
And they had locks on, and all the rods were put in there from one season to the next. The clients' rods, and the gillies looked after them and took them out and cleaned them, oiled them, and ready for the clients coming.
The gillies and the sports, huh?
Yeah.
Well, this has been great. Thank you so much, Chris. I'm just trying to think. Questions?
Yeah, I want to see the reel.
Do you mind if I got a shot of the inside of that reel?
No.
Is there anything that you want to say before we let you go to
dinner?
No.
I'm all right, April.
You are great at interviews. Why are you nervous?
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Birds up in the sky. Through the Blackwater bayous and in the dark Louisiana night floats a duck camp, alive with the sounds of swamp pop and the smells of Cajun cooking. From the Mississippi Delta in Venice to the Cajun prairies of the Southwest, me and the Duck Camp Dinners crew will be hunting and eating it all.
This is Duck Camp Dinner.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.